Hi, my name is Chris Bowman. I'm from the National Research Council, Institute for Biodiagnostics, and I want to talk about dimension reduction for microarray data. And I'm going to be talking. Can everybody hear me, by the way? So, give you an outline of what I want to talk about. Give you a brief introduction of what microarray data is. I'm not a microbiologist, so there are probably people in this room that understand the subject better than I do, but I'll do my best to introduce you to what the data is. Overview the problem, which is basically that microarrays are an experimental methodology that allow you to collect massive amounts of data associated with each individual sample or patient you're looking at, and how do you navigate through this data, simplify this data into something that you can understand, and go over some of the existing methods that I'm familiar with. There's loads of methods for sort of simplifying and understanding microarray data, and leave it, the rest of it, as an open question. So loads of inspirational quotes and things here, but the basic idea is we're going to be collecting tons and tons of data. And the idea is to try and get an idea, get some feeling as to what the data is, what information is present in the data, what the sort of important stuff that we want to get out of the experiment is. So microarrays are a relatively new high throughput data gathering technique. They generate tons and tons of data. What they're basically doing, I showed you a picture of a microarray on the first slide. There are a bunch of spots on a glass plate that come in various shades of green or red, and each one of these spots gives you some information about what a particular gene in your host organism is doing at the time you collected the sample. I'll be more specific in a minute. Typically, there's about 10,000-ish spots on a glass slide, which means you have about 10,000 numbers associated with each patient or sample in your experiment. And typically, there are on the order of dozens or hundreds of samples in a given experiment. Now, these spots tell you gene expression levels, which is basically a snapshot of how active a given gene is at the time the sample was collected. These things aren't independent. Genes are interconnected in vast, complicated networks where the activity of gene A either supports or inhibits the activity of gene B, and so on and so on. These things are huge, massive networks. So you get these thousands of numbers, but they're not independent of each other, and the number of samples is typically very, very small. So I am not a microbiologist by any means, but we'll give you a very, very quick introduction to molecular biology. Things are made up of cells. Inside cells, you have DNA. DNA is basically instructions that tell the cell what to do and how to make the proteins that they need to do to perform whatever job they're required to do. So genes are just pieces of the genome that are responsible for making a certain protein. They aren't always working, and they're not always working at the same level. When they're working, they're said to be expressed, and there's maybe 30,000-ish genes in a human genome. Not all genomes are the same. Rice has about 60,000, which is kind of a humbling thought. But so cells are different due to the fact that they have different gene expressions, and gene expression happens from environmental factors. If your cell is stressed because it's, I don't know, not getting the nutrients it requires, it turns certain genes on, it shuts certain genes off in order to respond to the stress. So the expression level of the genes at any given time gives you sort of a snapshot of what the cell's doing, or what condition the cell is under at any given time. The way this works is your DNA in the cell gets transcribed into something called messenger RNA, which then goes out of the nucleus into the ribosomes to these little machines that are essentially responsible for making the proteins. mRNA is essentially a copy of the gene, more or less. It's kind of imprecise language, but it's essentially a copy of the gene that gets carried outwards, translated into a protein, and then the protein does some other post-translational stuff and goes and does whatever it's supposed to do. So the levels of mRNA are essentially a snapshot of what genes are active at any given time. So the way a microarray experiment works, it allows you to get a idea of the relative levels of gene expression between two different samples at any given time. So you have these 10,000 spots on your glass chip, and what they are is tags, basically. Wow, there's an example. Whole bunch of spots. Red channel and a green channel. Because there's two different populations, the red channel is giving you expression of one sample, the green channel is giving you an expression of a different sample that you're trying to compare. For example, if you're trying to compare the expression levels of, I don't know, your population may consist of mice that have a certain kind of cancer versus mice that have don't have that. So you get expression from your cancer line, you get expression from your healthy line, and each one of these spots, the intensity of that spot tells you the activity of the gene it corresponds to. And some examples, there's an example from yeast. What's typically done is these two red and green images are superimposed upon each other, so you get something that's sort of various shades of red and green, where red means one population is expressed higher than the other, green means the opposite, and yellow means they're both doing about the same thing. And so on and so forth. So how microarray experiments work. Pick your cell populations. Let's say I want to take, I don't know, something I'm going to get RNA from. Brain biopsies. Extract your mRNA from the sample you got. There's some technical steps in here where this mRNA has to be a reverse transcribed, but it doesn't really matter. You take the stuff into something that's more stable than mRNA, basically. You label your samples with these fluorescent dyes that are either red or green, and then you wash this stuff over this glass plate, and the mRNA that corresponds to a gene that's expressed is going to stick to the appropriate spot on the plate. So if I have, so I have this messenger RNA, it's got a fluorescent molecule attached to it. You wash it over the plate, and when it sees a spot on the plate where which corresponds to the piece of DNA it comes from, it's going to stick to that, and it's going to carry a fluorescent molecule with it. So you're going to get a green or a red fluorescent molecule attached to that dot. The more copies of the messenger RNA there are, the more are going to stick, and the brighter signal you're going to get from that particular channel. That's the picture of what I was saying. And another example. So, once we've got this data, which is essentially the best way to, or the way I typically view it is, it's, you know, a snapshot of how much differential expression there is, how much more active a given gene is in population A versus population B, in tumor versus normal, in, you know, infected versus not infected, or so on. What kind of task do you want to do? Well, there's a bunch of stuff people typically do in these experiments. Cluster genes together, which is to ask the question of what genes tend to work together at the same time. Remember I mentioned earlier that there's these gene regulatory networks where the output of gene A turns on gene B, which then goes on to turn off gene C, and so on. And these things are connected in this highly complicated network. So it's interesting to say, what genes tend to activate together, tend to inhibit together. Classifying genes into functional classes, which is a similar problem. You can also do the same thing with samples. What gene discriminates best between two different kinds of leukemia, for example? I have sample A, which is infected by, you know, brain samples infected by scrapie, and sample A, which is normal. What sort of genes are discriminated against that, which is going to give you some sort of idea of what mechanism the disease is moving through. Identifying biomarkers, that's what I was talking about. And then the big one, which is inferring this actual regulatory network, which is a huge task. Identify which genes turn on other genes, turn off other genes, and so on. But the unifying task is really one of geometry, essentially. These experiments typically consist of, let's say, on the order of 100 points that live in, let's say, a 10,000 dimensional space. You know, every one of these dots can be coded as a number. Each one is, if you think of them as independent for each other, for, at least for now, can be thought as a different dimension. So I end up with 100-ish spots corresponding to my samples I'm looking at in a 10,000-ish dimensional space. And the idea is, what sort of underlying structure do these points exhibit? if any. So 10,000 dimensions is a little bit bizarre. It's certainly something we're not familiar with. In a lot of ways, infinite dimensions is easier to deal with than 10,000 dimensions. You know, taking the limit as you go all the way up. Bizarre things happen in high dimensions. Volumes of spheres grow really, really quickly. Almost all the volume of a sphere happens at the surface of a sphere, and points essentially get really, really far apart from each other. So the number of points you need to do any kind of reliable density estimation for a probability density function grows exponentially in the number of dimensions. Just bad things happen. I tried to illustrate this. You know, if I crowd my points in one dimension, they're kind of crowded together. If I pop them up to two dimensions, you can see you can kind of split the red, the green, and the blue apart from each other. In three dimensions, things tend to look like, or you can at least imagine things are a little bit sparser. So now just sort of go down the list until you hit 10,000 and get some idea of what's going on. But basically what happens is points get very, very far apart, and you need a lot of points to sort of trace out the boundary of a region. Which is bad because we're never going to get that many points from an experiment. If you have 10,000 genes, you're never going to get anywhere close to the number of actual samples you need to trace out any kind of complicated region in these spaces. So one hopes that even though I'm living in a 10,000 dimensional space, the interesting action is actually going on in a much lower dimensional manifold. And there's a fair bit of evidence for this. This is just another idea of what happens, problems with dimensionality, which is if you want to do classification problems, which is one of the main things people are interested in doing with this stuff, try to predict whether someone has disease or not based on the microarray data set. Test set error, which is the actual error you're concerned about. The fewer samples you have, the fewer features you need are required to give optimal test set error. So if you have loads and loads and loads of features like you have in these microarray experiments, you tend to get really, really awful test set performance unless you're very careful to restrict yourself. So there's loads of benefits for trying to take this data and project it, restrict it in some way to a much lower dimensional set. Even if the cost of that projection is to lose a little bit of accuracy or information. Ideally, two or three dimensions, because then you can see what's happening. So that's the basic problem, mathematized here. Given a set of points in a high-dimensional linear space drawn from some probability distribution that we don't really know, find a much, much lower dimensional nonlinear potentially manifold that approximates the points well. And I'm going to leave approximates well vague for now. But at a minimum, it's going to require generalization, which is it can't just do good on the data points I have. It has to do well on points that are going to be drawn from the distribution V in the future. And this is sort of the crux of the matter, because it's really, really easy to do well on the data you have. And let's assume the dimensions prescribed beforehand. It's really, really easy to do well on the data you have. So here I just picked a bunch of points in two dimensions, the blue dots are the points, and gave myself two different solutions to this vague problem I had, which is find a one-dimensional manifold that spans these points. The red one spans them exactly. There's no error at all. It's just a polynomial fit through these 10 points. And so there's no error on the points I have, but one can imagine that if these points are drawn from some sort of distribution that's clustered along that line, the red manifold's really not a very good solution to the problem, especially where these things swing way down up here and at the other end of it. You're doing really, really well on the data you have, but you're not going to generalize well. This is sort of your standard example from, you know, interpolation numerical analysis courses. Whereas the green line is just a straight line, best straight line approximation, which one would hope would have a better generalization properties. So how to deal with generalization error? Typically the way it's done is some sort of cross-validation procedure, which is you take your data, you hide some of it, you do what you're going to do, and then you check it on the stuff you hid away. There's lots of different ways of doing this hiding. The problem with hiding the data is that you don't have a lot of data to start with, so if you hide some, you got even less. And this is a very active area of research. How do I predict my error on future samples? without hamstringing myself by limiting the actual data I have to work with. And I'm leaving this as sort of a open reference area right now because I don't want to go into too much detail. But in general, there has to be some way of hiding data away which you can then use to test your model. So I should say, actually, from the previous slide, that when one's constructing these low-dimensional manifolds, there tend to be lots and lots of techniques to do this. It's not always possible to take new data and check it, which makes the technique essentially not usable for us. I don't want to go into too many details of some of the neural network sort of architectures that people have proposed, but you know, they get trained on the points you have, and then when you want to attach a new point, you have to essentially retrain the entire system and draw a new manifold to the new point. You can't say, where is this new point going to fall on the manifold I generated from the old data? That makes it difficult to do any kind of cross-validation. So I'm just talking about projection quickly. The easiest way to do dimension reduction is just to project things onto a lower dimensional subspace. There's good projections and there's bad projections. Imagine, again, I want to do a classification experiment where I want to separate people that have leukemia from people that don't have leukemia. Well, if I project things down in such a way that my leukemia class and my non-leukemia class get smeared together on the lower dimensional space, then I've pretty much killed myself. I can't do anything. So there are definitely good projections and bad projections. Here's my little toy slide. Choice of projection tells you what's going on. Oh, is it going to work? It's not going to work. Well, if it was working, there'd be like this nice animation thing where things rotate and you get a cloud of points that forms a penguin. So I want to, in the time remaining, essentially give you a laundry list of techniques that have been used in the past, and I'll essentially go until I'm out of time, which I think I almost am, and just to give a flavor of sort of what has been tried in the past, how it works, and where it falls apart, and then we'll throw things open. So the simplest thing to do is something we call correlated feature extraction, which is to say that these things live in families that behave similarly, so why would I want to consider the behavior of every possible gene when I could just look at the behavior of families of genes that cluster together? So that's simply it. Is there a question? Right. You take the genes you have, you cluster them together into functional groups that are going to behave the same, and replace the cluster by, let's say, its mean, and look at the lower dimensional space that way. It's not going to significantly distort the data, and it makes some biological sense because you expect a lot of these genes to work in concert with each other. And it's a projection onto a space spanned by indicator functions, basically. So this is what's going on here. I mean, I have my two classes. I say that feature 1 and feature 2 correlate well with each other, so I'm going to replace them with the line that's 45 degree angle between them and project onto that line. And as long as things will line up that way, I'm happy. And an example. This is just a heat map showing the correlation between, you know, feature A and feature B. The thing on the right is that same heat map thresholded. This is after a certain sorting has been done on the features. Same thing thresholded, and we drew little black boxes to show which features are getting grouped together. So you go down from, you know, in this case, about 1,500 dimensions to about 100 dimensions, but 100 dimensions is still a lot. Oops. Yeah, 100 dimensions is still a lot of dimensions, and it still makes things difficult to understand. There's another strong drawback, which is it can be fooled by things that I call switching modes from a different background, which is if I have things that have low energy but are important, I get in trouble. For example, if I'm trying to classify things where I have, you know, separate red dots from blue dots and they follow that way, then this projection onto this line, 45 degree angle line, is going to be a disaster. How am I doing for time, by the way? Okay. So the granddaddy of linear projection methods is principal component analysis, or Karhut and Lev decomposition. Goes by both names. It's in some sense the optimal linear method based on variances. And the idea is you get your cloud of data points, you find the direction of the data which has the greatest variance, you make a note of that, you remove all the variance in that direction, then you find the direction of the data of the next greatest variance, and so on and so on and so on, until you get this collection of directions that are orthogonal to each other. And you truncate that when you get down to a level where you say, okay, there's not enough variation in this direction to matter, and I keep my first n components, and I've just projected onto a much lower dimensional space. And there's many variants of this. It's been around forever. Yeah, I think I told you all that. Again, same basic problem. It's more or less exactly the same problem, which is that if I have a direction which has low variance but is important to me, I lose it when I do my I can potentially lose it, at least when I do my principal component analysis. This is going to be a universal problem. It's always going to show up, and it's something that is going to need to be addressed. Yeah, there's a question right at the back. I think the only answer to that is maybe. Knowledge of the biological system is definitely something that's important, but it's not complete by any means. So somebody can come and tell you that, you know, this doesn't make sense because we know this gene codes for something that has nothing to do with the problem. So, you know, we have to think a little bit harder. Conversely, one can say that I know these things are going to be active. I know these guys are going to be involved. So anything that comes up with has to preserve these things. And this is typically problem dependent and is going to change as the sort of state of the art changes. But in principle, it's not always going to be something that's available. So there's lots of variants of principal component analysis that do various things. You can rotate your principal component analysis to try and get sort of data that, you know, you like better, because it's really the subspace that matters, not the principal components itself. There's also local principal component analysis, which is going to segue me into the next class of methods. The first two things I talked about, the correlated feature extraction and principal component analysis, are both linear methods. You find a linear subspace, smoosh your data onto it, and you're done. But obviously, things aren't always linear. This opens the sort of door to the possibility of various nonlinear methods. The simplest of these is local principal component analysis. You sort of take little chunks of your space, do PCA in that spot, find yourself a low-dimensional linear space there, and you glue these linear patches together somehow. And gluing these patches together is not necessarily an easy thing to do. I'm going to skip this, actually. So I wanted to get the local linear embedding because it comes from here, or it comes from the University of Toronto. It's an interesting idea by Sam Rowise and Saul. The basic idea is if your data is clustered on a manifold in high-dimensional space, that manifold will hopefully be locally flat and not have edges and kinks and things in it. So you're going to use local linear information to reconstruct that data. So it's a lot like the local PCA I was talking about briefly earlier, but this is something that gives you a way of doing the gluing, basically. It gives you a way to patch these locally linear pieces together. Like many of these things, it tends to come from vision. What happens in vision is you get a bunch of images coming from a robot camera. that are very high dimensional because every pixel is its own dimension, but that really have some low dimensional structure to them. But, you know, if I take a camera and fly it through this room, there's only, what, maybe six parameters that it controls, the three places it is and the direction it's pointing. So if I, you know, everybody stands still, I run a camera through this room and rotate it in a certain way, I'm actually, you know, traversing a path on a relatively low dimensional manifold through the space. So projecting on a low dimensional manifold is something that happens in the field of vision and artificial intelligence a lot. And this local linear embedding is designed to sort of find these low dimensional manifolds. We've applied it to biomedical data with mixed results. We tend to find the generalization error, which is how well the manifold generalizes to new results, is a little shaky sometimes. And there are some pathological the data you project down onto the low dimensional manifolds tend to have some sort of stringy structure to it that we don't understand. But it's a pretty good start, actually. I'll give you an idea how it works. So the idea is you construct a distance matrix of all the pairwise distances of the points you have. This is feasible because typically you're only going to have several hundred at most actual points in your high dimensional space. So I can construct a distance matrix that says how far point A is from point B. And then I approximate every data point as a weighted average of its k nearest neighbors. So you pick k, approximate each point as a essentially interpolation between these k nearest neighbors. And then you look for a set of vectors in a low dimensional space that matches that same distance structure. And that gives you your reduced coordinates. And it's all fairly quick. So here's a picture from Sam Rowise's webpage, I believe, illustrating how this works. You take your points, select the neighbors, construct your weight matrix, and then find a bunch of points in a much lower dimensional space, which reconstruct the same weight matrix. And there are algorithms to do this stuff. It's essentially linear algebra. As I said, it works very well in the field of vision. We've had some problems applying it to biomedical data, and I'm not sure why we've had problems applying it to biomedical data. Possibly because the biomedical data tends to be very sparse compared to data from computer vision. And so this is sort of one of the open-ended questions to leave for the week. And I think I'm going to call it a day, or call it a morning. I'll be around all afternoon.